Blog Talk Radio.
Gentlemen, let's broaden our minds. Lawrence? Batman soundtrack. And of course, that is our honoree that we'll be discussing tonight. The immortal, the one and only Prince. Folks, this is our tribute to Prince, brought to you by the Rattlegion Broadcasting Network. And I am your host, the Man Data Reporter, and frankly, I'm very sad at the passing of one Prince. If you came here looking for The Long Road to Ruin tonight, that show is being preempted, being pushed back till next Thursday, because we lost one of the great ones, and like we did with the David Bowie show, we're going to play some of his songs tonight, tell some stories, talk about what he meant to us personally here at the Rattlegion Broadcasting Network, and send them out with a hero's farewell. Somewhere out there, Prince is picking up his guitar that looks like the sign that he called himself way back when. I guess it became the sign for love. It's an awesome-looking guitar, by the way. The one he played at the Super Bowl. He's up there in heaven. He's playing that guitar. He's joined by such luminaries as Michael Jackson and Kurt Cobain and Jim Morrison. And my special guest tonight, my co-host, just heard me mention Kurt Cobain and is wondering if he himself should blow his head off. Ladies and gentlemen, the punchy pugilist, Mr. Pat Mullen. How you doing, sir?
This show, you mentioned Kurt Cobain.
Talk into your microphone. That's how this works, sir.
Kurt Cobain, really? We couldn't get away from that?
My show, I can call on Kurt when I want. I did mix it up. I said Michael Jackson. I said Jim Morrison, Elvis. I'll throw him out there. But yeah, Kurt Cobain.
And then moving right along.
Pleasure to have you on, Pat. You were, of course, on our show when we gave Bowie his farewell. Took us all by surprise. I mean, these are not young men, but these are not necessarily very old men either. And we are losing them seemingly left and right. 2016, the year of surprise deaths. We had heard earlier this morning, late last night, early this morning, that former WWE star Chyna had passed away, and you'd think we would be, you know, we'd have a few minutes to process that before we got hit with another one this afternoon, the sudden death of Prince. And I never knew Prince to be into drugs or scandal or anything else like that. I thought he was an awesome musician, maybe a little weird. But other than that, you know, he didn't seem to carry with him a whole lot of scandal. So I didn't know he was sick. And when I heard he died, I was shocked, I tell you. How did you take the news? And tell me some of your thoughts on Prince overall.
This one hit me pretty hard because I'm a pretty huge fan of Prince. I've got a ton of his albums. Really, my favorite era is probably the Revolution era. I think most people would probably say the same thing, but just going back to when I was, you know, walking around in diapers and hearing the Batman soundtrack, and my favorite part of that entire movie is the party man scene where the Joker and his thugs commandeer this, you know, artsy-fartsy restaurant and just repaint everything while this awesome song is playing in the background. And I ended up loving the song so much that I got the cassette of the soundtrack from the movie. And that was the first Prince album I ever owned, because as I got older and I learned to appreciate certain things about music, I really, more so than his singing or his character, I really was fascinated by Prince, the guitar player and the musician, and got such an appreciation for his talent that that's what really hooked me. And then you look into it further, and this guy is one of the most creative and diverse and incredible performers, not just in music, but in any milieu. And this is a really tremendous loss for entertainment as a whole.
The music industry truly lost one of, as you said, one of the most creative people in the history of music. I wasn't kidding when I said, you know, he's up there with the great luminaries. There'll never be another Prince, and there's never been anyone quite like him. You're talking about somebody who connected races, was able to get past all these different musical sounds. He wasn't just R&B, he wasn't just rock and roll. He was so many different musical styles that they say he created his own style, the Minneapolis sound, whatever that is. Maybe it's the sound of large Viking men suplexing people. I don't know. But nonetheless, he was truly a unique voice in the history of music. A little bit of my own history. I was born in 1976, so I start to become aware of music and the culture around me at, say, 6 or 7, like any other person. And this is the early 80s. And if there are two cultural icons of the 80s in music that stood out to me that you couldn't escape, that whether or not you liked or liked the music, you had to appreciate their part of the culture that they owned, it was Michael Jackson and Prince. And years later, I would, as much as I saw the movie Purple Rain as a kid, and I would appreciate those songs. I still love them to this day. When I became a teenager and I went to college and I was big into the dance scene, I would go to 80s clubs and go out dancing with my friends to goth and industrial clubs. Prince was a staple of the set. Many nights, I would get my disco boogie down to Raspberry Beret or Kiss. There's so many songs that they would play by Kiss in the Kiss that they would play by Prince in the club that I came to appreciate as an adult. I never owned any of the Prince albums, and I think that's just because this was an era, obviously, you know, where you had to buy cassettes or albums, and there was only so much cash I could get my hands on as a kid to get to the store. I think the first cassette I ever actually bought myself, where I went to the store and bought it and it wasn't bought for me, was Metallica's Black album. So there you go. But I mean, other people would buy me stuff, and I was sort of my collection would range from like Paul Abdul to Motley Crue to Guns N' Roses, because that's what people bought me. Had I had access to, like my kids do now, Apple Music and Spotify, where everything's just at you know, a stroke of the key on the keyboard, maybe not so much for Prince, but you had, even tonight, gearing up for this show, I had the house going to the songs by Prince and introducing my kids to them, and I was happy to be able to do that. We're going to play a collection of songs for you tonight. But we're also going to take some phone calls. I want to go ahead and play the first track, but before I do, let me go ahead and bring on another member of the Rattlesnake Broadcasting family here. Go ahead. I know who you are. Go ahead. Speak on it.
Wow. Don't get a good introduction, Mark.
take command of the situation. Introduce yourself. Just kick open the door. Stop wasting time.
No, I mean, you know, I'm in the presence of greatness in you and Pat, so I mean.
Ladies and gentlemen, the Jason Teasley, the host of From the Chief Seats, which is currently on hiatus because there's no football season. But you didn't do a March Madness show this year. I'm really surprised by that.
I've been having a lot of personal issues going on, and just kind of had to take a backseat to podcasting.
And it also would have been good because he probably would have picked Michigan State like the rest of us and looked like an ass.
No, actually, I had Villanova winning it all.
All right, I want to get some of your thoughts here on Prince, but I also want to get to the music. So, Jason, why don't you hold on for a few minutes while we play our first track of the night here that isn't from the Batman soundtrack. One of my personal favorites, probably one of the favorites of all time, Prince songs. And if you're wondering, like, what order this is going in, or if we're going across, you know, the Prince spectrum, I literally picked 10 or 11 songs I really liked. And Pat threw in a few, and a host of the Casual Heroes and Bunkhouse Stampede, Gavin, gave me one. And literally that came to this. This is just like the Bowie podcast. Pick songs I remembered that I liked. And that was it. That's as far as the planning went. So here we go. This is When the Doves Cry. Again, welcome to the show here. Why don't you tell us a little bit about your thoughts of Prince, connection with When the Doves Cried, how you reacted to his death, the whole nine yards. The microphone is yours, sir.
Well, my introduction to Prince came back when I was younger. Very first song I ever heard was Raspberry Beret, and just that's back when MTV actually played videos. I know it's kind of hard to believe that they did that back then, but it was just there was just something about Prince and just his presence, I mean, and his musical ability that I actually liked as a young kid, and I just kind of the various songs. And as for his death, I mean, I was at work today, and somebody came in and was like, you know, did y'all hear Prince died? And I was like, okay, you know, you hear the hoax going on constantly, and then as more people keep telling me, I was like, well, I'm going to actually check into this. And I was at a facility, and they had it on CNN, and they was all watching and going on about it. And it said that he had passed away from flu-like symptoms, which will probably end up being he passed away from a heart attack once everything, autopsy and everything's done. But it kind of hit me weird because, like you said, in the 80s growing up, I was born in 78. You had two musical icons, Prince and Michael Jackson. And I'm reminded by an interview Eric Clapton done. They asked him how it felt being the greatest guitarist ever. And he said, I don't know. Ask Prince. And just Prince's impact on music has been far more reaching than people realize. I mean, he was a great songwriter. I mean, he wrote for every genre of music out there. And people don't really realize how many actually wrote songs for.
Pat, When the Doves Cry. Thank you, Jason. Pat, When the Doves Cry. What do you think about that song? Does it spark any memories of yours?
You know, this is one of those ones where I remember seeing the video really before I even heard the song. My introduction to the song is the video. And it had that split. There was duality. That was the whole theme of the video, where his outfit was duality. The mirror shots of him reaching out both sides, and the word painting is so vivid of this. And it's been interpreted in so many ways. I think the message of the song is pretty clear, but this is a very different song than a majority of his material that was coming out at the time, which was very based in sexual innuendo and in some terms very graphic stuff like Darling Nikki. Yeah, and this was a much more grounded, very, very visual word painting that he did that was completely commercially appealable. And for anybody who doubted his ability to do a great song that didn't have to be laced with these things, you have that here in When Doves Cry. And it's almost, you know, we're all wrestling guys. It's almost like when Roddy Piper got to have that match with Bret Hart, where he actually showed off that, hey, I can actually have a great wrestling match. I don't need to just go in there and rely on being a crazy street fighter every time. This is one of those moments for Prince, I think, where he got to have this song just to hang his hat on and say, you can say whatever you want to about my songs with sex, but look at what I did here. And, you know, Jason brought up a great point about Prince just being so instrumental in writing songs for other people. You know, like Prince has gotten songs that were hits for people like Sinead O'Connor, the Bangles, Madonna. People don't even realize that Prince was writing all this stuff, and not even just writing, but even I'm a huge fan of people will probably mention a little bit later too, Morris Day and the Time, because of their inclusion with Prince's stuff. And Prince not only wrote almost every Time song on the original albums and everything, but he was playing the majority of the instruments in the studio too, which is unheard of, the amount of work that it took, but he did it. And he basically launched the careers of people like Sheila E., Sheena Easton, so many people with his songs that he specifically geared towards them, that's one thing that may even outlast his own musical contributions.
Very well put, very well put. I actually have an article here from Yahoo that sort of sums up his career in numbers. He died at 57. Currently, Purple Rain, Little Red Corvette, When the Doves Cry, and Kiss are number 1, 2, and 3, and 4 on iTunes top song list, respectively. He began his career at the age of 19. He's released 39 albums. He's won 7 Grammy Awards. He sold over 100 million albums worldwide. His classic Purple Rain soundtrack, released in 1984, sold 13 million copies alone and enjoyed 25 weeks on the top music charts, which is unthinkable today. His movies Purple Rain and Graffiti Bridge grossed $73 million worldwide, 40 top 100 hits, 5 number one songs. Jesus. Inducted into the Rock and Roll Hall of Fame, as he should be, in 2004. And, of course, I just posted this on my Facebook page. He played the 2007 Super Bowl halftime show, which drew 140 million viewers. And, look, coming from me, this is, you could look at it as small praise, you could look at it as large praise. I'm not a huge fan of the Super Bowl halftime shows, especially when they were monstrous amalgamations of like NSYNC and Britney Spears and Aerosmith. And I like Aerosmith, but not when it's mashed together with all this other garbage. But I just watched that halftime show, and they're not kidding. It's really the best one I've ever seen. Speaking of the best, here's a song straight out of my youth from the movie Purple Rain. Here's the title track. Can't play all of it. We're going to play some. This is Purple Rain.
Well, that was some of it.
Never meant to call you in your pain.
can you hear me, Pat? Pat, can you hear me?
I heard Pat, but I couldn't. I can hear you, Mark.
You can hear me.
Yes, I can hear you.
Okay, good. Pat, can you hear me? Did you hear the music, Jason?
Yeah, I heard the music and I heard Pat talking during the music.
Okay, because Pat apparently couldn't hear the music or me for some odd reason. So I'm going to go ahead and go back and play the music. Jason, if you don't hear it, send me a message because then we have a problem. And I will let Pat know that everybody else hears it and there's a problem on his end. Okay, so take two.
All right.
Time, we're going to move on here. Pat, are you back?
I am back.
Excellent. Did you hear those soulful sounds of Prince's Purple Rain?
I didn't, even if I didn't, that's not a song I'll ever forget and pretty much know by heart. You talk about a guy who creates this magnum opus and just delivers on it. That's really Prince's magnum opus is Purple Rain, the single. And in the movie Purple Rain, a lot of people throughout the movie are constantly doubting him when he's playing the opening parts to that track about what it is, and they don't get it, and it's not going to work. And releasing a 7-minute song to try to get commercial airplay with is usually a suicide mission. But Prince is a guy who's always been, I know my art, I know what this is, you're not going to tell me I can't do this. And I don't necessarily think that the movie is transparent to real life in that regard, or it is transparent to real life in that regard, is I wouldn't doubt for a second that Warner's, who were his parent music company at the time, were telling him, absolutely in no way are you releasing a 7-minute track as a single. This is not going to land, like, no. And he probably had to fight them tooth and nail. And when it finally did get released, Warner's had egg on their face because it's his most anthemic, famous, really the one thing everybody will associate with Prince is the song and the movie Purple Rain above all else. And for them to try to not have that go through, it's one of those things where it's like, you should have listened to this guy all the way through.
Listen, no, yeah, people who heard me talk about movies know what I think of studio execs. And in many cases, the same thing applies to album executives, record executives as well. Sometimes I think they cut their nose off to spite their face, or they just don't have the vision of the artist. Now, in many cases, sometimes you need to rein in an artist who might be going off the rails, but I think more often than not, you have a special talent like Prince, and you just got to let them paint. You know, you give them as much canvas as they need, because they're going to paint you a very, very pretty picture. Jason, Purple Rain, go.
Like Pat said, this is probably Prince's most iconic song. I mean, there's been many, many covers of it that honestly do not do this song justice, especially with the movie. Like you said, people need to realize that Prince was ahead of the curve on so many things, especially musically, that if he knew his art better than anyone else, when he had a vision, just step back, don't meddle into it, and just let him be the artist that he was and paint you a beautiful picture, like you said, Mark. So, like I said, this is definitely his most iconic song. If anybody has lived under a rock and has never even heard of any song, other song by Prince, they definitely have heard of Purple Rain.
Absolutely. It's up there. It's his Beaded. It's his Thriller. In the sense that, you know, when people think about Prince, if they know nothing else, that's the song they think of. But I'll tell you, as a young little Mark Rattledge, the song that drew me to Prince, the very, very first song I ever heard, because it was on the Purple Rain soundtrack. And I didn't know it at the time, because I grew up listening to rap music until I was 12. I did not know that this song would be the one that would spark what would become a lifelong affair, a lifelong love of heavy metal. That particular song, one of my life mottos, let's go crazy.
Dearly beloved, we are gathered here today to get through this thing called life. Electric word, life, it means forever, and that's a mighty long time. But I'm here to tell you, there's something else. The afterworld. A world of never-ending happiness. You can always see the sun. Day or night. So when you call up that shrink in Beverly Hills, you know the one. Locked down, they'll be all right.
Crazy. It's 323-657-0901. 323-657-0901 is the guest call-in number for you to go crazy and tell us your favorite Prince stories and memories. Guys, are we going crazy? Huh? How awesome is that song? That to me is the best.
When I started going to dance clubs regularly in, you know, like the late 90s, early 2000s, that was the period of time where every other song was a remix of somebody else's song at that point in time by a quote-unquote DJ. And the remix they used to play of Let's Go Crazy, it would usually be cut in by something else, but that was such a big hit at the time in those clubs, like in South Brooklyn and going over towards Queens, like all those clubs, it would always find airplay every weekend. And like, it was just, everybody legit would get so pumped up when that came on and just started losing it. And this is a song that, you know, was over a decade old at that point in time, but it was still reaching people the way it was intended to when it came out.
It does go to the timelessness of Prince's music. Everything he said at the beginning there, and it shows you how my mind works, I was thinking that this needs to be covered by Clutch, and he needs to leave in all that stuff at the beginning about telling your therapist this and that, and you know that sort of preaching that he does without actually sounding like a gospel preacher. And maybe he does, who knows? But I love it. I love it all. I think it's actually very timely with the way the culture is now. Jason, your thoughts on Let's Go Crazy?
Oh, my thoughts on Let's Go Crazy is when they televise his funeral, that's how it needs to start, is the beginning of Let's Go Crazy and end with Purple Rain. Because, I mean, it just the beginning of that song is just, it kind of embodies Prince's outlook on life regardless. I mean, he was always an upbeat person. he was very spiritual and everything. And he always liked having a good time. That song is actually the beginning when I played basketball and played college ball. Everybody would always have their headphones on and everything. That song was the intro to my warm-up mix, as I guess you could say. And it was a reason because, I mean, it's a song that actually gets your adrenaline pumped and gets you pumped up. And, you know, it's something that is timeless. Like I said, I mean, that song actually, like Pat said, it spans generations. I mean, it's, you could probably go hear that song at a club right now.
Very much so. Very much so. So, I don't know about you youngins. I say this to Jason, who's only 2 years younger than I am. But you babes in the woods. I don't know if you know this or not, but when you guys were taking your allowance money over to the Sam Goody at the mall and buying your cassette tapes, you may have noticed a sticker on them. It says, explicit lyrics, parental guidance. Is known as the Tipper sticker. What's Tipper? Who's Tipper?
Tipper Gore.
I'm getting there. It's like the one part of the show I can do. Shut up.
It was rhetorical.
Yes. Stay with me now. Tipper Gore, is Al Gore's wife. Al Gore was at the time the senator for Tennessee. And he would go on to become the Bill Clinton's vice president, and then he would go on to quote unquote lose the election to George W. Bush, and then he would go crazy. Not the good kind to go crazy in the last song, but the bad kind to go crazy where he makes ridiculous documentaries. In any case, not that kind of show. We're moving on. So his wife, if you were to believe the legends. And there was actually a movie about this, so I'm going to speak from how the movie portrays it.
Starring Jason Priestley.
Yes. Essentially, they were Tipper and her daughters were in the Gore homestead, and they were jamming out, listening to Prince. And the song in particular that they were listening to was Darling Nikki. And now, Pat, what's Darling Nikki about?
Well, if I'm to quote the lyrics, Darling Nikki at one point was on the bathroom floor masturbating with a dirty magazine.
Now, if you're Tipper Gore, proper Southern wife, wife of a senator, raising pure white as driven snow daughters, you probably don't want to hear that kind of music in the house. So she has a bright idea. She says, hey, had I known we were going to be listening to Smut, I would not have played said Smut for my children. And oh my goodness, did you know that the Smut was on the radio? So there was a movement to try to censor music Jello Biafra of the Dead Kennedys would be put on trial for delivering obscenities through through an H.R. Giger photo that was inserted into one of their albums, one of the Dead Kennedy albums. Oh, gosh. There were a couple of artists who testified before Congress. Dee Snider of Twisted Sister, Frank Zappa. John Denver. There was a whole to-do about the music industry, and ultimately what she wanted to do was a rating system like we have for movies. The problem is, when you think about how many movies are released compared to how many albums are released, it was impractical. So the compromise solution, what ended up becoming coming out of this, was what we call the tipper sticker, the parental guidance explicit lyrics. And so, folks, we have Prince and Tipper Gore to, at this point, it's almost become irrelevant with the way music is now and streaming services and whatnot.
And when it was initially put onto albums, it basically guaranteed them hit status.
In some cases, it also guaranteed that if you lived in, you know, let's say you lived where Jason lived, where no one lives in West Virginia, you know, and the only place that you can buy music is Walmart. You almost guarantee you weren't getting that album if it had a tipper sticker on it into Walmart. For years, actually, they would release two different albums, a tipper stickered album and a non-tipper stickered album that was pre-censored, where they would take out the curse words or whatever. And those they could get into Walmart in some cases, and other stores that were abiding by a religious decree. But yeah, that's what we lived with for a while. Hard if you're youngin, if you're an actual youngin and you're listening to this, it's hard to imagine that we would go from Darling Nikki to, you know, to what we have now, and in between the tipper sticker would become meaningful and then completely lose all its meaning whatsoever. It literally does nothing to help anybody. I don't even think anyone notices, especially when all your music is online. But let's go ahead and hear the culprit of it all. We can talk a little bit about it after the fact. This is Darling Nikki. I threw out a lot there. Tipper stickers, Tipper Gore, Al Gore. Obscenities, obscene lyrics, Darling Nikki itself, Prince. What do you make of it, Pat Mullen?
You know, it's not even the most outright offensive song he's ever written, if you've ever heard Pussy Control.
Not sure Pussy Control ever made the radio. Maybe it did. Who knows?
But I mean, this was the song that like was, I think it was actually number one on what Tipper Gore deemed the Filthy 15, which were the 15 most obscene, offensive songs that she found on the radio. Not coincidentally, I believe also I believe it was Sugar Walls by Sheila E. was on there as well. And to the surprise of none, Prince also is responsible for writing that. And yeah. I don't think you need to be that brilliant to figure out what Sugar Walls is a reference to.
Candy stores?
Exactly.
It's a clean show here, folks. Family oriented. Pat, did you own a lot of Tipper Stickered albums when you were a kid? If you had Tipper Stickered albums, were you allowed to own them, or did you have to hide them from your parents?
I think at a certain point, I only had Tipper Stickered albums for the most part, unless they predated, you know, the Tipper Sticker. In some cases, my vinyls did that I bought, you know, some of like Van Halen stuff prior to the breakup and everything. But, you know, from like 91 on, almost any album, and I think up to a certain point, every album I got was a Tipper Stickered album, because there just wasn't anything that they would let get through uncensored unless it was like a Raffi tape.
So I poked a little fun at you in your homestead there in West Virginia, Jason. I tweaked your nipple a bit, but now's your chance to get me back here. What was it really like for you in West Virginia? Did you have trouble getting different albums, or do I not know what I'm talking about and it was fine and you could find them anywhere?
Actually, there was just like little record stores that would carry both versions, and you could pick them up fairly easily. But if you went into the quote unquote local store, we've only had Walmarts for a little while, you know, about 20 years. But back then we had Ames and Hills, and that's all you found was Tipper Sticker stuff there. I mean, so yeah, but the little side mom and pop record stores, you could get both. You have your choice of both versions. And that song was actually, it's been covered in various other outsources. I mean, the Foo Fighters have done a cover of that with guest starring CeeLo Green, of all people. Nicki Minaj has done a cover of it. That song even got a parody, I guess it would be a parody, on a Fresh Prince of Bel-Air on an episode when Will is stuck in the basement during the earthquake. He does a kind of a parody.
Oh, with Tisha Campbell, that's right.
Yeah. Yeah, he does a parody of it. The song has had an impact not only, you know, through the Tipper Sticker and everything. It's also reached, you know, something as wholesome as Fresh Prince of Bel-Air doing a parody of it.
I don't think Tipper did a very good job ultimately of sparing America's impressionable youth from smut. I would say the legacy is that it was an utter failure. Couple of things here. My most prized Tipper Stickered possessions growing up as a kid, this will tell you a lot about me and how I was raised. The first one was two
Fear of Black Planet by Public Enemy.
Well, yeah, of course. But besides that one, that's number three on the list. The first one was Two Live Crews, As Nasty As They Want to Be. As many people have heard me say on this show, black butts. Yes, ladies and gentlemen.
Yes.
Girls, black butts in bikinis, and Luke, whatever the hell his name was.
Campbell.
Was he? Okay. Just, you know, and a bunch of guys buried in the sand, staring up at him, crotch deep. That, of course, I couldn't wait to listen to that when I got home. That was a gift I got from my father for getting a good report card. That was a lot about my father.
isn't he currently the president of the whatever city in Florida Democrats?
Yeah, he's an official with the local Tampa Democrat Party. And I believe he also used to do something with MoveOn.org, but that's, you know, my father and what he does podcast will be on at a later date. The other one, my other prized possession, was I had an original, with Cop Killer included, original Tipper Sticker and Body Count album. Oh, Body Count was the best. If people have already heard us on the Metal Hammer of Doom, we covered the original Body Count album, and I think I threw Cop Killer in there. We also covered last year's new Body Count release. So people already know, if they've heard the Metal Hammer of Doom, what a big Body Count fan I am. Yep, I had it. I had an original with Cop Killer before they had to take it off after the whole Rodney King riot. So yay me. The last little story on this, on Tipper Stickering and keeping smut away from children. I worked in a record store when I was in college, and some blonde little girl walks in. She had to be like 9 or 10. If she was a little older than that, whatever, but she was still young. Young enough that this story should make sense here. So I'm working. So I don't know anything about hip hop at this point. I've been listening to metal for years. Again, I'm in college at this point. I don't know any of the modern rap or hip hop. And this blonde girl just looks like she walked right out of the suburbs of Long Island, where only the white people lived, comes into my record store, walks up to me and says, "Hey, do you have the song where the chorus is, just put it in," and she proceeded to sing it to me. "Just put it in your mouth.
Put it in my mouth." Yeah.
In your motherfucking mouth. And like,
you can lick it, you can lick it, you can taste it. I'm talking every drip drop, don't you waste it. It's finger licking good, and I wish a nigga would go down.
I almost fainted like Tipper Gore would have. I'm not even joking about that. I was like an antebellum woman for a moment. I was like, "My dear." So that's my that's how I relate to Darling Nikki. Years later, I would be threatened by a blonde girl wanting that song. All right, moving right along here. Another one of my favorites, another dance classic. This is Raspberry Beret. Start off with Jason this time. Jason, Raspberry Beret. Any thoughts? Any memories?
This is one of my first introductions to Prince, because it still holds a very special place. I mean, it takes me back to simpler times in my youth, I guess you could say. But Raspberry Beret is just so smooth and mellow that it. It's one of those songs that can bring you out of a bad mood just because of the music and Prince's vocals on it. It just kind of brings, it's not way too poppy like music tends to be now, but it's just one of those mellow, just relaxing songs that you could listen to and just go to a happy place.
All right. Pat, what do you have to say for yourself?
The main reason I like this song is because it's one of the ones where he really gets to showcase his vocal range, because he doesn't have dynamic instrumentals in the background of this one. Jason says a real simple melodic beat throughout, but he gets to hit several different vocal ranges in this one particular song, especially towards the end, which we're unfortunately not going to get to hear. But again, we're talking about how multi-talented this guy is as a songwriter, as an artist, as a musician. As a singer, he's pretty darn good too, and this is one of the songs where he really gets to cut loose at certain points and let his full vocal range go, and it's really impressive.
Okay. I don't have a whole lot more to add to that. Like I said, it's everything you guys say I agree with. It was a dance classic. It was a dance favorite. It was one of the ones I would hear in the clubs all the time, and if I wasn't dancing, that one would definitely draw me out. The next song on the hit parade was a single that was released in 1983 from the album 1999, which we'll hear later. This one ran as high as number 6 from what I can see here on the Billboard chart. It was one of the most popular songs of its day. This is Little Red Corvette.
Yeah.
Take a ride in a Little Red Corvette and share some of your memories of Prince. The call number is 323-657-0901. Pat, I can hear you through. I can hear you over the music. I can hear you through the microphone. You got very excited there. What's going on with you?
I did. Little Red Corvette is absolutely my favorite Prince song. Just awesome melody. Great singing. The word painting is pretty epic. His guitar playing when he decides to solo in is phenomenal. Just something about this song clicked with me from the second I heard it, and just was always like, this is my freaking favorite Prince song. This song is amazing. Probably one of my five favorite songs ever by anybody, period. Just everything about this hits with me, and I can't fully explain why. I can tell you, like I told you before, great music, great singing, great work, but it's just one of those songs that it invokes that feeling out of you where you're like, damn, I love this. And that's ultimately what the goal of an artist is, to get that kind of reaction from anybody. And man, oh man, did it work. And I think my biggest regret about this song is there's not actually an official music video for it, but there is an unofficial one of Prince actually performing it live in concert. And man, I've gotten to see it. And you talk about a guy with so much energy, so much presence, rocking the song to its fullest in a live performance. It was incredible.
Yeah, the man certainly oozed charisma. It looked like it came quite naturally. God only knows what he was like behind the camera, behind the door, you know, in private. Charlie Murphy, so funny how people react to things. I can tell this story related to this song. So I came home, and like I said, yesterday my daughter came home singing the Descendants cover of, not the Descendants you guys might be thinking of, Descendants, the Disney show, Dove Cameron.
Not the Descendants I was thinking of.
Not the Descendants you'd be thinking of, no. They did a cover of Genie in a Bottle, which my daughter has been singing incessantly, and so we said, listen, there's better pop music out there than this. So... We spent some time going through some YouTube videos and turning her on to, you know, like late 80s, early 90s, even some late 90s pop music. And, you know, we were having a good time with that. So tonight I came home and I said, all right, tonight, you know, no TV. We're just going to listen to Prince music until it's time to go to bed. Did not play Darling Nikki, in case anyone was wondering. And that's what I needed to do to sort of process this whole event, this loss of a great artist. My wife approached it a little bit differently. One, not a fan of Prince. She was on for our Bowie show, and that affected her deeply. But Prince didn't affect her one way or the other. She's not a fan. However, the death affected her in the sense that it made her want to go rewatch the Dave Chappelle clips of Charlie Murphy talking about Prince and playing basketball with him. So I'm at my computer downloading Prince tracks, buying an album off of Apple Music, because apparently it's the only way you can get his stuff unless you want to steal it off torrent.
And meanwhile, you've got Melissa Radulich sitting in front of the TV listening to Pancakes, Bitches.
Yeah, right. Blouse. Search for some blouses. So, yeah, we were having a good old time here at the Radulich homestead. Jason, Little Red Corvette.
Little Red Corvette. I mean, it's one of those songs. I mean, it's a fun song. I mean, the dynamic changes from slow, methodical, then it goes upbeat, then it slows right back down, and it paints a very, very nice, vivid picture that, like, puts you in the mindset of the song. And it's just one of those songs that I can listen to, and anytime I hear it, I want to sing along with it, just like Pat did. I mean, you know, of course, Pat's lovely voice can sing along with any 80s song. But it's
a human auto-tune.
Yeah. But yeah, Little Red Corvette is ranks right up there with Raspberry Beret with me. I mean, it's a very close second in my heart. And it's like I said, it's a very vivid song that takes you. It paints a picture very, very nicely. So and that's what music misses now. I mean, it actually makes you feel invested into the song.
Are you trying to tell me that songs like Crank That Soulja Boy don't paint you a picture? Don't answer that. Let's just move on. so our next track
Blouses.
That we're going to hear. Go ahead.
Blouses.
All right. Straight out of 1979's Jukebox, and yet another one of Prince's many singles, the follow-up to... For You, which I believe is what I'm reading here. This is I Want to Be Your Lover. His first successful single and the first top 40 hit, scoring 2 weeks at number one on the R&B singles chart in December 1979 and peaking at number 11 on the Billboard Hot 100. So Wikipedia tells me. I'm a smarty. No, but I tell you, you know, we hear so much about you know, his R&B style and his rock and roll style, and that one was clearly out of the disco era. Whether he was trying to, you know, capture the disco movement in his music or how much it influenced him, I know part of the Wikipedia entry says that this was part of a series of songs written in haste as they did, because Warner Brothers wanted a follow-up to For You. So it's entirely possible he was like, oh shit, what's popular? Yeah, this is popular. But I tell you, it made me think of the vinyl season finale. I don't know if anyone's watched it yet. If you haven't and you're into the show, spoilers. One of the things that the show does at the end is sort of give us an introduction to the disco era. And that's what this reminds me of. It's what sparks in my mind. I actually never heard this before. So that was a first for me. How about you, Pat?
You know, this was one of the ones I requested when you were like, what are some of the songs we need to play? And I was like, and I looked at the list and it was pretty comprehensive, but it was Losing This. And I wanted this included, A, because it is really his first real hit. And two, because Mark, you might remember because you did grow up in the New York City, greater New York City area. In the late 70s, early 80s, late at night on like Saturday nights on the local channels, there used to be all kinds of different shows that would spotlight music acts, if you remember. I don't know if you remember any specific ones, but.
No, go ahead.
They were like basically localized versions almost of like Solid Gold and those type of shows. And
I definitely remember Solid Gold.
Well, yeah, these were like the localized versions of that. And they would take place in places like Studio 54 and later on Limelight and places like that. And one night at Studio 54, they happened to have this new guy that was kind of made causing a stir named Prince. And this was the song they played on the show. And this was really his introduction to a lot of the greater tri-state area and our area. And it started blowing up on the New York airwaves, specifically on the disco charts and the R&B charts. And this was kind of the benchmark song that a lot of people who are from where we're from were first introduced to him and kind of started this whole following of this guy's pretty good. What's he going to do next? And it is kind of his only real disco oriented song that has hit. For You is much less disco, much more funk R&B. And there are traces of very R&B songs in here. But one of the reasons I also wanted this included was, you know, you guys know I have a background in boxing, and when you box to warm up, you shadow box. And a lot of times you'll put music on that you can move to and roll with. And for me, I don't know why, but it's always been easiest to get rolling and work up a good sweat when I have some kind of R&B or dance music playing. And this was a staple of like my shadow boxing, you know, playlist, for lack of a better word, because we didn't know what a playlist was back then. But this was one of the songs that I would warm up to like habitually. And it just, for some reason, it's always stuck with me. And I just enjoy the song to this day.
You know, as much as I know you are a soulful, rhythm-oriented singer, it's very hard for me to imagine you warming up to beat someone's head in to I Want to Be Your Lover.
Actually, believe it or not, this and James Ingram are staples.
I don't doubt it, and I understand what you're talking about in terms of rhythm and you know, and getting your body to move to the music, and I understand that on that level. It's still really funny. Be like, all right, here I am preparing to beat someone's head in to I Want to Be Your Lover. You know, it's always, I always find that funny, like when people come out at an MMA show and the music totally doesn't match the tone of what's about to happen. Jason.
Well, like I said, if it makes you feel better, the next song that I would play would be There's Got to Be a Better Way by James Ingram.
Fair enough. Jason, any thoughts on this before we roll on to our next track?
No, I mean, you could tell it's the disco era, and that's actually the first time I've actually ever heard that song by Prince. So, I mean, it's very, very 70s-ish. So, but I can understand where Pat's coming from, you know, with the thing and using that to warm up to, because, I mean, you kind of do it in basketball, too. You start out kind of something methodical, you know, just to get you ready, and then it kicks into something a little bit more hard. So I can understand where Pat's coming from in that aspect.
Sure. So this next song I completely confused with a Roxette song. This is You Got the Look.
You walked in, I
kind of a dope. And like when they, it's not one that I'm familiar with. This was one that was suggested, and so I'm listening and I'm like, yeah, man, she's got the look. I love that song. I'm like, that's not fucking Prince, you dummy. That's Roxette. So that was a good song, though. I like that. That's 1987. It opens the second disc of Prince's 1987 double album, Sign of the Times. There's a insignia there. And became the album's highest charting single. And the year that it was released as a single was 1987. And it definitely is a representation of 1987. Nice combination there of pop, funk, and rock. Good stuff there. As far as being introduced to a new Prince song, I really like that one.
Jump right in, guys. I was going to say, Sign of the Times was a really experimental album from Prince, because if I'm not mistaken, it was the first departure he had from the Revolution as his backing band, and he was drifting into a different kind of tone. So, I mean, You Got the Look is kind of a more pop-friendly, again, radio-friendly offering from him. Where he had songs on that album that were, really, really delving into some subjects that he hadn't touched on in depth before, where he has a song called The Cross that's basically about spirituality and him exploring themes of Christianity, which he eventually converted to later on. He had a song called If I Was Your Girlfriend about gender identity and androgyny. So Sign of the Times is a pretty loaded album, and that, while it's you know, a fun, like, pop song, You Got the Look, it's also really only scratching the surface of what he was trying to do with that double album, because there's that album has so much packed on it that it's like listening to maybe four or five different artists, but with that unifying Prince vocal and certain guitar sounds and rhythms in each song that you know it's him putting it all together.
All right, Jason, why don't you go ahead and give us a little bit on not Roxette's She's Got the Look, but Prince's You Got the Look. And then we'll move on here to a final couple of tracks.
Well, I mean, I there's not much I can say that you two didn't already cover, so I'm kind of speechless. You guys already covered everything that needs to be said about it.
All right. Our next track here is a doozy, because most people might know it as sung by Sinead O'Connor, as I like to call her. Sinead O'Connor. Of course, this is Nothing Compares to You. But it is actually not her song. This was actually written and performed by a band called The Family in 1985, which was released on Prince's Paisley Park Records label. And he, of course, plays in the band, along with some others. This was the sixth track on there. It was on the second side. People listening to this in, you know, modern times, second side. What does he mean by that? Records used to have two sides, see? Anyway, so yeah, Nothing Compares to You was one of the songs that was on it, and then was very much made famous by Sinead O'Connor and her cover of it. That was a huge hit. This is the original by Prince and The Family. This is Nothing Compares to You.
Whoever
If you ever have an opportunity, if you're into punk rock, listen to the Me First and the Gimme Gimmes cover that. It's pretty
such a great one.
Yeah,
such
it really
a great
is.
One. And they're a great group in general.
Yes, that album Take a Break where they do nothing but R&B covers is a phenomenal record.
Yeah, my favorite is the Straight Up cover.
Yeah, that's a good one. Any case, Nothing Compares to You, As Made Famous by Sinead O'Connor, originally by Prince's The Family. I've never heard the original. You know, I like everybody else on Earth, I heard it. You know, when Sinead O'Connor. made it
you
popular, so that was a fun experience.
You know what I compare these two? Ironically enough, I'm comparing them. To me, these two songs, talking about the family version and the Sinead O'Connor cover, I really find them reminiscent of Whitney Houston's I Will Always Love You, which people tend to always associate that song with her, when it was originally a Dolly Parton ballad. And
mm-hmm.
I think in the cases here of the two original recordings, I think they're a little more stripped down and a little more, as a result, at least to me, a little more soulful and do what the song intended and touch your heart a little bit and kind of get to you, whereas the other ones are very over the top and bombastic and produced to be hits. And they're certainly great songs in their own right and great performances. But there's something really beautiful in the simplicity of the first two in comparison to their predecessors.
Another comparison I would make where an artist records a song and then someone comes along and covers it and everyone associates the cover as the original, almost to the point where the original artist just says, fuck it, it's your song now. Especially in the case of the one I'm thinking of, Bob Dylan's All Along the Watchtower, which was then covered and made famous by Jimi Hendrix on Electric Ladyland. Most people assume it's his song. And I think even Bob Dylan has gone on to say, yeah, it's his now. You know, it's all yours, baby, because he did such an amazing job with it. So another, you know, fun tale there of musicians sharing songs and producing some wonderful art.
Was this your first – I was going to say, guys, to both of you, is this your first time hearing anything by The Family?
Yes,
it's my first time.
Mark, we did the show about David Bowie, and we talked briefly about his foray into a side project when he had Tin Machine. But we talked about how Tin Machine really sucked because Bowie was in the real depths of his drug addiction at the time, and creatively was just so spent that Tin Machine wound up being a really sad kind of – people were worried it was going to be the end of his career. The Family was nothing like that for Prince. I thought The Family was a cool creative outlet, and I highly recommend you check out some other stuff because he doesn't have to – really do anything other than what he wanted to do with The Family because he didn't have a major label, you know, overseeing his creative process. This was all released on his own. So if you've never heard of his stuff with The Family, I highly recommend it. And the only reason The Family didn't take off is because he was constantly having to work for his own solo career, in my opinion, anyway.
Okay. Robert Winfrey chimes in from the Cheap Seats saying, Metallica's Turn the Page, people associate Turn the Page because of the video, and I mean really what American youth today listen to Bob Seger, but Turn the Page, originally a Bob Seger song. Most people would associate it though with Metallica and assume it was one of their songs, which is odd because it was on a collection of covers, but nonetheless, moving along, we're going to wrap this podcast up in a couple of songs here. We are running low on time, so let's keep this party moving with some Diamonds and Pearls.
Gonna do. If I gave you diamonds and pearls.
tonight. All right, so Diamonds and Pearls came out in 1991. It was the 13th studio album by Prince and the first to feature the backing band The New Power Generation. So guys, we have a ton of singles that came out of this, Diamonds and Pearls being one of them from the self-titled album Diamonds and Pearls. It's a great song. A fun song, definitely in the later years, one of his more popular songs. Jason, any thoughts here?
Yeah, this is back when Prince started having his, what people like to say, identity crisis, to go on to become the symbol and everything. And it speaks to how well Prince was ahead of the curve, because some of the stuff that he done on this album and later on is, you see a lot of influences now in the pop music that people, well, what people consider pop music now. And Prince was revolutionizing that back in the early 90s with some of the musical hooks that he came up with and everything, and the just the style in general. And he didn't like to conform, because back when this was coming out, Prince kind of seen what was mainstream, and he veered off and done his own thing, and still was just as popular as, you know, the mainstream stuff. So.
All right. Very good, Jason. Pat, any thoughts here before we go to our last track?
Yeah, this was just a point in time where he was introducing the New Power Generation, and every album really had like four or five distinctive different sounds on it, and he would release four or five singles that sounded like they were coming from different bands. He would release, you know, like you take this song, Diamonds and Pearls, and compare it to the first single that came out off that album, Get Off, and two entirely different songs that sound like they were coming from two entirely different groups. So this was kind of where I almost kind of fell out of being a Prince fan for a while, because I didn't get any, you like a band because they have a certain sound, a certain presence, and I think Prince was losing that. Jason alluded to the identity crisis and the name change. This was kind of where I started to not be as thrilled with his stuff, until probably when he put out the Gold Experience was the next album I really kind of fell back into. It was like, okay, he's back, and that came out I think it was something like 7 years after this.
Yeah, like you guys, once he changed his name to The Symbol, I think he got too weird for me. And there was a period in my life where if it wasn't metal, I wasn't listening anyway. So I fell away from Prince. And so there's a whole swath of his career that I just didn't pay any attention to. It was something I have to go back and re-experience. Certainly now, at my wizened age of almost 40, I can go back and appreciate some of what he was doing and experimenting with. But I think, I think when I think of Prince, I always think of stuff that we played earlier in the evening. This is our last track of the night, and then we're going to say some final goodbyes as we celebrate the life of Prince. We're always celebrating here on the Rattle Legend Broadcasting Network. We are never mourning. We are celebrating the life and what these artists brought to us, because without them, we would be very, very sad, sad people. Because we are celebrating, you know, we're partying, we're going to party like it's 1999. Yeah, we're going to party like it's 1999, gentlemen. I think it's a fitting tribute to Prince and his legacy. I think it's a great song to go out on. We're actually going to go out on a different song. But as far as talking about things and making mentions and telling stories, it's the last track we're going to hear tonight. So let me just say for myself, I've had a great time revisiting the early years of Prince and reconnecting with what I loved about him so much. And, you know, my kids' generation, I hope they will listen and appreciate and know that we lost one of the great artists of our age, and he'll never be replaced. There'll never be another Prince. I don't know if they'll ever truly appreciate that. Who knows? But certainly, I think the people who knew him and were fans of him understand that. Pat, any final words here?
Yeah. At a time when I was pretty consistently only trying to listen to really, you know, classic hard rock and heavy metal and that type of stuff, Prince was always somebody who could break through and make me listen to his stuff and make me, you know, really evaluate what I thought was good, what was real craftsmanship, and what was beautiful music that I could listen to at any point. And there's three particular albums I'll shout out if you've never listened to them and you've never listened to Prince and this is your first exposure to them, that I think you do yourself a tremendous service listening to. One of them is Purple Rain, the soundtrack. It's incredible from start to finish. One of them is what I just mentioned, the Gold Experience. That was kind of after a lot of years of an identity crisis musically and personally. It was a return to a real great form by Prince. And I'll also throw out 2003's Musicology, where Prince had kind of been off the map for a while and came back in a big way with an album that was Prince doing what he did best, blending funk, rock, and R&B into some great songs and just kind of putting the music world back on its ear and saying, oh, Prince is back, and he's still just as good, if not better, than everybody else. And I'll just always love his music. It's always going to reach me and have me just thoroughly enjoying it. And it's a real loss to me personally that he's gone and I won't be hearing anything new from him.
Unless they find some of his old stuff buried in a drawer somewhere and then make him a hologram like they did with Tupac. Speaking of holograms and Tupac, Jason?
Just closing that. I mean, Prince was basically my introduction to a lot of music. It's going to be, like Pat said, it's going to be surreal not being able to, you know, bask in some new material for him, because he was so revolutionary in the music world. And it's just one of those things that today's music is nothing compared to what all three of us grew on and what we were accustomed to as great music, such as what Prince gave us.
Well said, well said. All right, folks, that is the Rattledge and Broadcasting Network tribute to Prince. I want to thank Totally 80s Pat for once again providing a brilliant history and insight into another lost treasure from a decade gone by. I want to thank Jason for being coherent and alert during our podcast. No, thank you, Jason, for lending your appreciation of Prince to the podcast. It was greatly appreciated. Again, for those of you who thought you were going to hear Long Road to Ruin tonight, that'll be back next Thursday, and then we'll be doing part one of The Hunger Games and then Catching Fire, and then the week after that, which is the Thursday that Civil War comes out, we'll be doing Mockingjay part one and part two. So that's all for now. Go ahead into the archives, listen to Robert Winfrey and I review The Jungle Book, and check out all of our great podcasts. Also, if you're interested in, if you liked Pat tonight and you're interested in hearing what more he has to say, listen to him talk wrestling with Gavin Napier and sometimes me on the Bunkhouse Stampede Radio, brought to you on blogtalkradio.com, Stitcher, and iTunes. Just search Gavin Napier and you will find the Bunkhouse Stampede. You can also go to thecattleheroes.com. Stuff is replayed there. And go ahead and listen to Jason Cheesley here on the Rattledge and Broadcasting Network, along with Jesse Starcher, as they bring you sports, and from the cheap seats. Some of their old shows are some dandies, and hopefully they'll come back and give us some new shows very soon. Also, you can hear Jason Teasley on the occasional Source Material podcast, talking comic books. So go ahead in the archives, find what you like, give it a listen. Give us a whirl and a twirl on Twitter. You can find me at Mark Radulich, MarkRadulich. That's MarkRadulich on Twitter. I'm also on Facebook. If you decide you're going to friend me on Facebook, tell me who you are first. Because if you just blind face friend me, I'm going to delete you because I'm going to assume you're spam. So tell me that you heard the show and that you want to be friends, and I'll be more than happy to. I've friended a number of our fans of the Rattle Into Broadcasting Network, and they are fine people. All right, so we're going to go. We came in with Batman from 1989. We're going out with Batman. Ladies and gentlemen, thank you for listening to our tribute to Prince. Be well, be safe, and behave. Let's dance to the Bat Dance.
Oh, I got a live one here.
Ooh.